Hey guys, this is Nikhil.
And this is Nick.
And welcome back to Informatonauts.
Episode number 11, with a little bit of a break in between the last one, but we are back at it again, and glad you guys are tuning in.
And we're going to commemorate by going back to the good old-fashioned MacBook and dropping the condenser mic.
That is true. So apparently the condenser mic that we normally use has gone missing. So this tinny, delightfully tiny sound that you'll be listening to is, like I said, just like the good old days on episode one.
So apologies in advance. But you know what, Nick? It's spring in Seattle right now.
It is 100% spring in Seattle right now.
I've been enjoying working outside.
It's been amazing. I've been getting off the bus early and walking along and doing my thing. So it's been really fun.
Cool.
Yeah. So how was your spring break? Did you do anything interesting that you think our listeners would be fascinated with?
Nope, not at all. The only interesting thing I did was nothing. Absolutely nothing, and it was everything I imagined it could be.
That's awesome.
To quote Office Space. So, yeah, how about you?
Yeah, I had some house guests with me for a couple days, and then I went down to San Diego to visit the family, and that was about it. So nothing super fascinating or interesting, but it was a good break. So
cool.
Back in the classes again, and ready to finish out the year strong, I think.
Yeah, there was one class that our friend Ty told me about today, which I didn't hear about. But apparently it's a night class that goes from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. about data visualization. And it sounds interesting, but I just don't know if I can swing a four-hour class.
Yeah, 6 p.m. to 10 is pretty rough. I did a 5 to 7 last quarter, and that was pretty good. But that's a big difference. It's like twice as long. I don't know if I could do that either. Do you know who's teaching the class?
Cecilia Aragon.
Okay. I don't know. Not familiar with that name. But yeah, that sounds quite awesome, though. Too bad it has to be set up the way that it is.
I know. I mean, I want to take it. I just don't think I will.
Very good. Well, I'm only taking one class this quarter. I'm taking Society and Health. So it's basically intro to sociology or sociological methods and concepts for public health individuals. So it's a pretty large class and one of the collaborative learning areas. So in the new library here at UW-Odegaard. And yeah, so we're all kind of like oriented around tables. There's about 12 people at a table. Each table, there's about 10, has a giant flat screen TV, three HDMI and VGA inputs, microphones so that you can kind of be heard around the class if you're going to be answering a question or presenting or something like that. And it's really designed to foster that group work and group mentality. The problem is that they're pairing this together with a really traditional like lecture component. So it's just as you imagine whenever you're at like one of those like receptions and you're all seated around those large tables and you have to turn around and crane your head. Mm-hmm. Imagine doing that for an hour and 20 minutes twice a week.
That's brutal.
It's not my favorite part, but it'll be interesting to see how they continue to integrate the new layout and technology into the traditional class mindset.
Well, tell me this, Nick. Is all the stuff from Microsoft, has it just been donated?
I didn't see any plaques on the door when I walked in,
okay,
which normally indicates donation. I don't think so. I didn't see a lot of Microsoft stuff, actually. Of course, all the switchers and the control components are Crestron. Like most places are, and the TVs are Panasonic commercial or something like that. So I didn't see that necessarily was donated. I'm sure there are others, but
well, the reason I ask is because if you go to the EE building, you see a lot of stuff outright donated, just given to us.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, as UW students, we actually get free copies of Windows.
We do. We get free copies of a lot of stuff. Like we get Microsoft Office, I think, get some of that stuff as well. So
yeah, big
that's
perk.
Pretty impressive.
Big perk of going to
it
UW.
Is. Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. So, anyways, oh, another fun story with this class. So I bought the book online. It was written by a prof down at the University of Alabama, I believe. And so I bought it used off Amazon. It came. I started flipping through and noticed some writing at the beginning of the book. I was like, oh, well, that's interesting to see somebody like mark their copy. It's like, I wonder who had this book before me. And I flip it open, and it's signed by the guy who wrote by the author who wrote the book, and some like personal note to one of the students or whatever. And I thought that was really cool. That I just, a lot of times you'll see it if you zip through on Amazon, if you go to the marketplace and you click on, you see something that'll sometimes say collector's edition or something like that. Usually they'll put it there and mark that it's been signed. But this book had no markings or indications. And I just kind of flipped it open and there it was. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Lucky you. That's awesome.
Yeah, I thought that was fun.
You know, Edward Tufte, he actually sells, so you can buy his books online on his mm-hmm. website. But as I recall, you can actually also buy his books in a signed bundle. Like for $150 or $200 or whatever it is, he'll like sign a book, write your name in it, and send it your way.
That's kind of awesome. Now, Tufte is the father of data visualization or something.
I don't know about the father, but he's a pretty big name.
Okay,
and he's very opinionated. That guy. So
yeah, isn't he the one that says don't use that hates PowerPoint?
Yeah, and pie charts.
Oh, pie charts. But yeah, they're so tasty.
And I think he's the guy who just like who completely just has destroyed pie charts. A lot of pie chart hate.
All right. Interesting.
At least one of them. One of the people. Well, I almost bought the Xbox One. I haven't not done it. It's in my Amazon cart, and I just haven't pulled the trigger. I can't do it.
Why? What is preventing you from buying this delightfully amazing piece of technology?
Well, one is the price tag.
Yeah.
Actually, on Amazon, I got it down to be about $450. Which is pretty good, and that comes with Titanfall and like all the other components that go with it, like the headphone and like what do you call that Kinect bar, the controller and all that stuff. And unfortunately, I don't have a TV I can use because I don't watch TV. I just have a nice big monitor and I watch Netflix on there. So I need to buy some kind of an adapter because it has an HDMI input and output. So I might be able to get an HDMI to DVI to connect it to my monitor, but I'm not going to have any sound. So I need to buy like some kind of adapter for that. And that's about $100. So, and on top of that is going to be this price tag of paying for Xbox Live mm-hmm. and then paying for Netflix as well. You know, I'm already paying for Netflix, but I can't get it for free through the Xbox One or anything like that.
Yeah.
So, a lot of just associated costs that go along with it.
Yeah, that adds up really quickly. You don't even realize it. Now, the bundle doesn't include a year of free Xbox Live.
Not a year.
A lot of them do.
I think it's a month.
A month. Oh, well, that's like nothing at all.
Yeah, it's just to get you started.
Yeah. Now, the Xbox Live, does it come with like the Xbox Music Service, or is it just the gaming kind of thing?
I think it – I don't know about the music service. I haven't looked into the music service, but then again, I'm not really interested because I already have Spotify. And yeah, actually, course. I think it was you and my sister simultaneously sent me like the same link to mm-hmm. Spotify, mentioning that they actually dropped their rate from $10 to $5 if you're a student.
Yep.
So
I did see that. I'm almost making the jump into.
Oh, do it! It's a no brainer.
Like, well, so here's the thing. So I don't find their ads to be all that obtrusive.
Mm-hmm.
So the ad thing isn't really a selling point for me. And I'm still old school. I buy CDs and vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
So I buy almost all of my – I buy all of my music. And I like to do that. I like collecting it and having the physical copy and all that stuff. So the ability to just have – I also like to buy – I like to control the rate at which I buy in order to like really be able to dig into an album and to like absorb it and all that kind of stuff. Whereas times when I go on music buying sprees, I end up like 8 months later, I'm browsing, I realize, oh, I bought this album and I listened to it like once. So my natural price constraints, I think, help me value my music a little bit more. So that side isn't really all that interesting to me. The offline mode is kind of cool. Of course, now they've added free streaming on iOS and then Android tablets. So that's a nice push. Although as far as I know, not Windows. I thought not the Windows Mobile or Windows Phone. I thought that they were going to. They just said all tablets and stuff, but maybe they just haven't pushed that update yet because I keep trying to log in on my phone and it keeps kicking me back out. So.
Okay. Yeah, on the other hand, I definitely love my Spotify and I don't buy any CDs or vinyl. I don't even have a record player. I mean, that's crazy that you have
Come
one.
On.
That's very Seattle of you. You are
You know what?
Seattle.
I had that record player. I bought my first record player when I was sophomore in college, I believe. And we used to listen to, my roommate and I used to listen to vinyl all the time. Our favorite album, we love Jack Johnson's In Between Dreams, the big yellow album. That sounded so amazing on vinyl.
You know, the question that I have is when you play a record on vinyl, People say that vinyl has a warmer sound to it,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, my inclination is to believe that it has to do with like the tube amp that is playing through, not necessarily the vinyl record itself.
No, it has to do with the nature of the pressing. Well, a lot of it, especially on cheap pressings or with cheap needle styluses that don't respond correctly, you lose a lot of the high end kind of transient, so you don't get that bright sound. A lot of the high frequencies kind of can get kind of mushed away. But the other thing that you get is fourth order harmonic distortion. And so that is what the human ear interprets as warmth. So you get that. You can introduce it through, it's introduced through like mechanical processes. So the physical moving of the stylus or through the processing of the tubes on an amplifier or something like that. So you can introduce it through a tube amp, but you can also get it. You get it through a record player as well.
Well, then conceivably, couldn't you write a computer script or a program to take a digital song file and then add warmth to it?
So yes and no. So they have a lot of those. You can get tube amp emulators. You can get all sorts of plugins for professional workstations like Pro Tools or Nuendo or Digital Performer. And so you can emulate the effect of going through like an old channel strip or a tube amp or something like that. Of course, it depends on the input signal, and it depends on what you're actually modifying, right? You have to have information there in order to be able to process. So you're not going to be able to really get that. You can get it a little bit. A lot of places, like cheap programs and stuff will kind of try and apply some of those effects to like an MP3 or something. But at that point, you've already smashed away. You've already stripped away a lot of the frequencies and the information that's already there, so you end up with kind of a pseudo effect. So I like vinyl for a couple of reasons. One is I love collecting things. I'm very tactile. I'm a collector. I love books and CDs and things like DVDs. And so vinyl to me is kind of the ultimate collectible medium for music. And I love the large art and there's something, you know, physical. There's something physically awesome about. Physically enjoyable about, you know, putting the record on and dropping the stylus and flipping it over to go to the other side. There's like a connection, a physical connection with the medium there. And then I do enjoy the audio. Cheap stuff like the crappy Crosley players they sell at like Urban Outfitters or whatever are just going to be really, really terrible. You're going to get a lot of warble. You're going to get the drive motors are going to like. They're gonna oscillate, so you're gonna get weird frequencies introduced, or with bad equalizers or things like that. So there's lots of things that could go wrong. That the chain can be really complicated, but I have a fairly simple setup. That's not amazing, but it's a Denon turntable into my Marantz amp with a I can't remember what it is a Jet Projects equalizer in the middle, and I get pretty good audio, and I enjoy listening to it.
Cool. Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned the word warble, but that kind of reminded me of wobble.
Yeah.
Like wobble bass and dubstep, and that got me thinking, you know, today's music, it's kind of, it might not be optimized to be played on a record player.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that it is. There are a lot of people that will disagree with me. I don't listen to a lot of modern music on vinyl. So I have, one of the records that I have is... I don't know if you're familiar with the band The New Pornographers.
Nope.
Okay, so they have an album that came out 2006, fairly good pressing, all that stuff, and I think it sounds like garbage on vinyl. I won't listen to it. I'll listen to the CD. It's a great album, but I hate listening to it on vinyl. The transients are really smeared. It has weird... It sounds kind of dull and just... I really don't like the way that it sounds, but it sounds fine on CD. Now that could be the pressing. I don't necessarily think so. I think that's more of the nature of the music. So I don't buy a lot of rock on vinyl. I have some old kind of classic albums that I've picked up. Like I have Steve Miller Band and I have like Pat Benatar that I picked up for like a dollar or two here and there. Mm-hmm. But my favorite albums are things like Bon Iver, his latest album. I have that on vinyl. I love listening to that. Wilco's Sky Blue Sky is one of my favorites. I have some Moby, some Cigaros sounds really good. And so those types of albums, you kind of think the things that would lend themselves to being kind of warm and fat and smooth, you're going to probably enjoy the sound of it on vinyl. So
interesting.
Yeah. So, but speaking of Urban Outfitters, we went into that when I was in San Diego. Went in with my family. We were shopping, and so we kind of browsed through that store. And I was walking around and looking at it. You realize that you are walking into a perfectly curated hipster experience.
Mm-hmm.
You look at, you've got all the right clothes, all the right books, all the right albums for, you look at some of these, like I know some of these bands, these are really terrible bands, but it's like all the ones that you should have just enough classic rock to like presume the cred, right? Just enough like weird European stuff, but nothing too crazy. And then all kind of like just everything was just perfectly laid out and set up for you to be able to walk in there and assume the experience and the role of the hipster.
Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of, I'm sure it's not an accident. And the reason why I say that is because I remember reading that Safeway, actually, what they do is they actually do data mining and informatics on their club card members.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember exactly where I read this. I would love to cite a source right now, but I can't. But either way, as the story goes, what they do is they go, okay, well, it looks like a lot of people who buy wine also like to buy stinky cheese. So they put the two close to each other. Mm-hmm. So that way, when you buy your wine, you also are going to see that stinky cheese and go, oh, well, since it's right here, I may as well pick one of those up too.
Yeah.
So, I'm not surprised. I'm sure it was definitely, like you said, a curated experience.
Yeah. You know, but it's interesting because it feels really false and kind of ridiculous. And a lot of people are up in arms about, they really don't like Urban Outfitters. Why? Because it's creating an artificial experience. It's like, it's telling you what you should be as opposed to allowing it to evolve organically. But think about all the other
society.
Yeah, think about all the other things in our life that are information aggregators that present an experience to you. Whether it's Safeway putting the beers that they know are going to sell. Well, you go to the beer section here in Seattle, and it's what, all IPAs and stouts. Like mm-hmm. That's what sells here. You go onto BuzzFeed or Lifehacker, and they are curating all the right things for you to enjoy and like. Why? BuzzFeed is full of cats and 25 things that suck about single people, mm-hmm. and then 25 things that suck about married people, right? And it's all with funny internet memes and stuff. And of course, it's because that's their thing. But or there's a great site called Longreads, which aggregates and curates long form content, so stuff that takes more than like 5 minutes to read from around the internet. And it's a phenomenal site. But then, of course, you're reading the same things as everybody else. You're reading the New Yorker, and I had the Weekly Standard on there, and that was kind of odd. But you're reading the New Yorker, you're reading Pacific Magazine, you're reading LA Magazine, like this kind of stuff. And so we accept that just kind of as a natural, way the world works, because there's just too much information out there for you to process on your own. But when Urban Outfitters does it, then it's like gross and ridiculous.
You know, I spent about a year or so creating a list of blogs that mm-hmm. I go through and read. And they're all my Feedly. But what I love about it is that I go through a number of them in the morning. And the next day in the morning, if you look at Mashable or TechCrunch or whatever, they have posted an article about one of the things in one of those blogs. So I feel lucky to have this little kind of
little jump start.
Yeah, you know, about a day or so. Not too much, but enough to be like, well, I read that already. Or, you know, it's nice to be able to do that. But at the same time, they're at the mercy of, you know, big aggregators like TechCrunch and Mashable and Lifehacker. They're at the mercy of the content that's provided to them.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there's like a number of people out there, a finite number of people, maybe 1,000, 2,000, whatever they are, who make this content on a daily basis or on a weekly basis. And I'm sure it's like they're repeat offenders. You know, they submit the, you know, they're kind of plugging their own company, or they're submitting content that's in their own vein. And they're doing it over and over and over again, week after week. And these places are just publishing them because they have nothing else to publish.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's also interesting that there are really, we talk about influence within communities and larger groups, right? There are some people that are very close to the source of that influence, and what they say really matters. You can find two articles that basically say the same thing, and one of them will be written by somebody who is closer to that center of power, and that will get picked up and spit out there and processed, whereas the other person may, you know, just quiet obscurity, quiet. So that, you know, that's an interesting, it's an interesting phenomena mm-hmm. of what it takes to like, of really who curates and aggregates the raw information. And it's probably a lot more complicated question, you know, answer than most people would assume, but.
I would hope that these, at least if I was running a company like that, I would do a lot of market research as to what people want to read.
Oh, yeah.
But that's just how I've been trained.
Well, of course. And I think these places definitely, they absolutely do, right? And they've been doing this for a while, and we just don't quite recognize
it. But they might do it by gut instinct. I don't know if they actually have regression models or, I mean, I would make like a regression model. That's what I would do.
Yeah, so I was reading, so I just finished a book last week called For God, Country, and Coca-Cola.
Mm-hmm.
About the story of the Coca-Cola company. And it's absolutely fascinating because it's so closely intertwined and parallels just the American experience, whether in lifestyle or mindset or anything like that. It was a fascinating book. And back in the 50s, they called it motivational research,
mm-hmm.
but it was basically behavioral science. And they started doing like data analytics and stuff back in the 50s. They hired a bunch of statisticians and bought some IBM, you know, punch card machines. And yeah, started figuring out optimal ways to market and target and like design all of this stuff. And it was totally data driven. I mean, way back in the day.
And back then, 10 megabytes was big data.
Oh my gosh. I mean, just, you know, again, you're stacking on punch cards, right?
It's like,
yeah, so that was absolutely, these places do that. I remember hearing another anecdotal story of Walmart. If there's ever a natural disaster coming towards your city, if you go to Walmart, you will see, was it in the center, like down the center aisles, you will see, I think it's batteries and Pop-Tarts. Because they've identified that like the number two selling item during like hurricanes and tornadoes and stuff like that, blizzards, are Pop-Tarts. Because they're cheap, they have a quick energy source, and they don't go bad, and they're easy to store.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So Pop-Tarts are the thing that they really sell. So that's what gets center aisle, you know, attention.
You know, one thing I think on the topic of food, one thing that I learned today from the Wolfram Alpha app, which I downloaded on my iPhone,
mm-hmm.
is that the food with the most calcium in it is the Starbucks espresso double shot.
Wow.
In a can.
Wow.
That has a ridiculous amount of calcium. It's like 18,000% for daily.
Oh, my gosh.
And not just calcium, vitamin B, B6, riboflavin, a whole bunch of other stuff.
Wow. And it's calcium.
Yeah, and it's like 10% of your like daily caloric intake or something.
Oh, my gosh.
Not 10%, sorry, 1%.
What?
Yeah, tiny. They just like pack it. It's kind of like the 5-hour energy drink thing.
Oh, my gosh.
Really interesting.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds so bad for you.
I'm sure it's terrible, you know, in large doses, but.
I mean, anything, your body is designed to like uptake nutrients in like a really holistic and systematic way.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the issue is like people take these multivitamins, right? They'll just like pop a multivitamin and go. And their body's kind of like, it's like, I don't need all of this stuff. I already ate. So it just like passes it through. I've heard stories of plumbers that'll like clean out toilets and stuff, and like they'll take photos, and you can see some of these multivitamins. You can still read like the logo on them.
Oh,
the body
terrible.
Just passes right, or just it just passes it right back out. So if you're gonna take, so like you, there's only so much that you can uptake in at certain times. So if you want to take vitamins, that's why you take them at mealtime, because then your body is like, oh, I'm in the two stages, but feasting and famine. So it's in the feasting stage, and so then it will take in like, oh, look at all this vitamin C that I have, and it'll like pull it in. But just like loading a whole bunch of calcium into your body, it just like passes right through you.
Yeah.
Or accumulates. Some of these bioaccumulators, they just like stack up in weird places.
I blame Dr. Oz. That's who I
blame. Dr. Oz?
Yeah, because I mean, he has that TV show, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he, I'm not saying he's a bad doctor. He does a lot of good for society. But at the same time, ever since he started to say, take multivitamins, I know a number of middle-aged women who just started to take a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
All the time, and they don't need that much.
Your body has to filter all that stuff out. It can be rough on your kidneys.
Yeah, it's not good to, I mean, balance is the key, folks.
I mean, 100%.
We're not doctors, but balance is definitely the key.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. We're not doctors, and we can't say this, not a real doctor.
Yeah.
Right, but you know, we know enough about biology and stuff to know that, that your body operates systemically and holistically. And so if you want to take a multivitamin, there are some that are really good. The one my family's been taking for years is, I think it's by the Chicago Nutrition Company or something like that. And it's, it breaks down really fast. It pops into the correct, like, you know, place in your digestive tract, but you take that with your meals. And so you, you pop one as you go along and, you know, you take one or two and you're good to go. And your body can uptake and process that. And it does add a lot of those like micronutrients and stuff that you need. But yeah, you get very little added benefit from just taking a whole bunch of them because your body's just like, nope, done.
Really, if you work your diet the right way, you are going to have more than enough of the required nutrients,
right? And vitamins. And the problem is that most people don't. And as you get older, there's certain compounds that you do that it's hard to get in a normal diet because you need excess amounts of it.
Of course,
yeah. And so in those cases, it can be really beneficial to take some multivitamins, but
yeah, especially close to menopause and
or men as they get older, right? It's gotta keep them prostates rocking.
Isn't it funny how menopause is like has the word men in it, but it happens to women.
It's sexist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do we have? Is it male menopause? Is that what it's called?
I don't know. This is a weird conversation to have.
Well, think about it.
I don't. I am trying to think about it. I know you get like decreased virility, like, but I don't necessarily know if you go through. I mean, our systems are so different, right? That. That I don't know if there is even a male equivalent in within the reproductive system. So
I'll have to look that up.
Yes, please look that up. I want to hear about this next week. So, and again, folks, we can't reiterate enough. We are not doctors. Nothing here should be construed as like medical advice or best practices, right? Yeah. So, and I guess, you know, if we're wrong, feel free to write us or shoot us a tweet or something like that. We'd love to argue about male reproductive systems over the public interwebs. It's kind of our jam.
You know, I wanted to ask you, what's your workspace like? Like, what is it, not just at work though. I mean, like at home and your mobile workspace. Like, what do you take to coffee shops and such?
Great question. Well, here at work, I've got a fairly nice setup that I like. I have a 27-inch monitor. I got a Shimian that I bought from one of those Korean 27-inch like cheapo monitors. And bought it, got it shipped over here. It's been working super well, plugged into my MacBook Air. And I've kind of been adjusting it so now I can get kind of both screens working. It's hard because my Air, you know, 13 inches, it's so small that it just kind of, the size disparity is really is a little bit hard to mess with, but I've been kind of tweaking it, getting it to work. I scored a Herman Miller Aeron chair that was sitting around here at the office. I stole it. And so that's my chair now.
And it's so baller.
Yeah, it's pretty baller. I got my external mouse. I love the Apple Mighty Mouse. Hands down my favorite mouse of all time. It's light, low energy, Bluetooth, all that stuff.
Do you mean Magic Mouse?
Yeah, sorry, the Magic Mouse. Yes, okay. not the Mighty Mouse. The Mighty Mouse is the one with the cord, right?
I think so.
Yeah, that's also a good mouse. But yes, the Magic Mouse. Absolutely love it. I know some people use like the trackpads and stuff. I don't like those. I just prefer my mouse. And I always carry that in my bag, so it's always with me. I do like to listen to some music when I'm working. I don't know how you are. But usually if I'm working really hard, it's either silence or music with no lyrics or something like that. But if I'm doing tasky stuff like answering emails or something like that, I'll listen to some music in the background. And when I have a pair of Alessandro Audio MS-1s. They're really nice headphones. But they're open back, so I can't listen to them in the office unless I'm the only one here because they leak audio or leak sound, but they sound great. So normally I have a ThinkSound. I think they're also the MS-1, I think, monitor series in-ears that I listen to when I'm in the office or out walking about. And I have it's a little Fio E17 DAC. Because the headphone output on the Mac is just absolutely, on the Air is just absolutely atrocious, like horrifically bad. So I have that I plug in that, and then I plug my headphones into that, so I get much better audio. So, and then some awful Microsoft like ergonomic keyboard that I desperately want to switch out, but Yeah, so that's my thing there. At home, I don't really have anything. I don't like to work from home. It's difficult for me to focus. I get really distracted. If I am working, usually I'm just sitting in my chair or on a futon or something. Sometimes I'll set up my laptop at my little table and work. But yeah, and then mobile workspace wise, I just usually the laptop, and you know, I get good enough battery life that I don't usually have to carry a charger with me. So. How about you?
So I also don't like to work from home. I actually have a dining table that I work at when I need to. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I also have a 27-inch crossover monitor. It's not quite the cheapo one from Korea, but it was pretty cheap. It was like $400 or $500 when I bought it.
Yeah.
And it's been pretty good so far. That's on my desk, and I use that a lot less often than I probably should use it, but it's there, and I do watch movies on it or whatever. But and it's nice to have a, you know, when I'm coding, mm-hmm. to have my stuff up on that screen,
yeah.
and my documentation up on that screen, and then like my like Sublime text on my MacBook, and just yeah. code away. So that's nice. But when I'm mobile, I just carry my MacBook with me, and that's it. Yep. I don't carry anything else. I didn't even consider buying a Magic Mouse and carrying it with me to work and back. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm looking for a new setup at work, though. I'm trying to get a new monitor so that way I can – something bigger than the 21-inch thing that was kind of issued to me.
Yeah, because that's not even a widescreen, right? It's like the like the 4:3, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty – it's annoying.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
It looks terrible.
The only other issue is that I was thinking about buying – you know, a shimmy or another crossover and just dropping it here off at work, but that's going to cost me $300 or $400. And on top of that, I don't think it can drive the resolution that I need on if I'm planning to get the new MacBook Retina.
Mm-hmm.
So although I haven't planned on doing that yet, it's kind of like an option that might happen at some mm-hmm. point. So I don't want to just like go ahead and buy the monitor and it's kind of in limbo.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You can't drive at that resolution. Supposedly, there's been rumors that Apple's coming out with some Retina quote-unquote displays, but actually the signaling protocol is like it's so much data that's going over that you have to use like dual display, like basically you have to run two Thunderbolt cables to it. Wow. Is the way that they think it's going to work right now. And there's a lot of information. They have some monitors that are coming out that are, you know, the 4K resolution, and those work pretty well with OS X, but they're like $2,800 or something. So, yeah. So it is a little bit in limbo. I love the 27-inch. I think the resolution is great. It works phenomenally well for what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I've been really happy with it. So, yeah. So that's how I do it. I tend to be fairly productive here at the office and stuff. So I like to have a little bit more. Our desks here are really narrow. I like to have a little bit more space to like be able to spread out and have my stuff kind of laid out. I don't get to do that quite as much here as I would like, but I'm kind of coping and dealing with it. So
right. I code at home, or I try to.
Yeah.
I get distracted fast. At work, it's pretty much I'm pretty focused. Although when I do come into work, I'm kind of a socialite, so I tend to talk to mm-hmm. lots of people. And like I guess past noon, it's just tough to get anything done. But I've started to come in early, starting today actually,
mm-hmm.
at like 8:00 in the morning. And man, between 8 and like noon, it's been like genius hour.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's been awesome.
Yeah, I usually come in. I've been coming in, you know, get a second wind about, you know, 7:00 or whatever. So I'll come in and work in the evening for a couple hours and nice and quiet here, just kind of get to focus in and no distractions. And I've been enjoying that. So
cool.
Yeah. So what have you been working on today? Anything exciting?
Well, I just wanted to take some, I guess, stock information about Tesla
mm-hmm.
from Yahoo Finance, like the historical thing that they have. They have this little function
yeah.
where you can download the historical data for any stock. So
yep.
I got Tesla, and I made a D3 visual to like basically plot out. Actually, I have it here. I can just pop it up and show you. It's just to quickly plot out. Oh, this is the wrong one. I have to restart my server to show it to you. Sorry. But basically, it's a stock like line that mm-hmm. reflects the price over time. And then underneath that, we have the volume
okay.
bar. So it was kind of like, you know, I'm just using D3 to recreate a chart that's been done before. Not that big of a deal, but at the same time, it helped me hone in my chops and really understand exactly how D3 works. It's kind of a tricky library. Yeah. Beautiful, useful, but very tricky to learn.
Okay, good. Well, then I've got some D3 stuff coming up here, so I'll look to you and pay you in beers to teach me or help me do it. So
yeah, I mean, I think it's really the documentation's kind of sparse for it, but once you get the hang of it, it's like, oh, okay, I get how this works.
Yeah, very cool.
How about you?
Well, I had big plans for being super productive today, and then I realized that it was Microsoft's Build keynote today, and that's all I've been doing.
What? Okay. Well, what's happened?
It's kind of an exciting keynote. So I haven't finished it yet. It's like 3 or 4 hours or something, about an hour and a half into it. So the first thing that they talked about was they announced their new Windows Phone 8.1, which is a tremendous update. And brings a whole bunch of things that have been lacking from the platform. Things like geofencing and like an alert or activity center. It added a bunch of enterprise support for like email encryption, VPNs, dual SIM, all this kind of stuff. Added a bunch more visuals of changing lock screens and some more customization, flexibility in adjusting rows, and some backend APIs to fetch data and things like that. It had an interesting app that they're releasing called Wi-Fi Sense, which allows you to configure not only different like access points to connect to, but also you can add in the credentials that are necessary. So let's say that you're connecting, so the Vancouver Public Library, to log into their network, you have to give them you connect and then you have to submit your library card and your PIN number. And so you, with the Wi-Fi Sense, you can add that in there, and it'll remember it. So the next time you connect to the library, it'll automatically push those credentials for you, and then you go, so you don't have to mess with that. They weren't 100% clear how they were going to do this, but they have a way that when you are connected to your Wi-Fi, you can, and your friend comes over with their Windows Phone, and they want to connect to your Wi-Fi, you can, instead of just giving them the access key, or just your Wi-Fi code, you can actually like directly connect, like give them like a temporary access credential, which only gives them access to the internet, not to like all the other stuff on your network and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it must do it with something with using like a UPN or something like that. So I wasn't sure exactly how they were going to do it, but that seemed kind of interesting and kind of cool.
Yeah,
the ability to have people basically hand out temporary tokens and have them kind of connect. So maybe they're using it through like Wi-Fi they have like the WPS, which is like you press the button and like put in the code and it just auto connects you and negotiates and that kind of stuff. So they must be building on top of that, but that seemed like a kind of a cool.
It's time to buy cool T1.
Way. What?
It's time to buy T1 and sell it to other people.
A T1, a fractional T1 line?
Yeah.
Fractional T1 lines aren't that fast. They just get guaranteed connection. They have low jitter.
Well,
oh, like 5 megabits.
Well, how about fiber? Can we get fiber around here somewhere?
And
sell that,
Seattle Gigabit. Yeah, I wish. Seattle Gigabit. There's two answers to that. One is you can't do that in your service contract. So the other one is fiber. Seattle's Gigabit Fiber project has kind of like died. So that's no longer a thing. And Google Fiber is expanding to like 12 cities, and Seattle's not one of them, unfortunately.
Yeah, did they say why?
Probably, I have no idea. They didn't say why.
They picked like the weirdest.
Part of it probably has to do with a lot of local and state regulation. They don't want to get into regulatory battles, so probably public-private partnerships. The cities are probably incentivizing and paying. So I think in Kansas City, their data hub is. The city basically gives them free space. So they have, like, I think they have a couple racks of gear, and so the city just gives them that and lets them co-locate for free there. So I don't know if Seattle even submitted a bid. Seattle was probably, when they were rolling this stuff out, Seattle was in the middle of the gigabit fiber stuff here, gigabit Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And so that probably was a deterrent, but I don't know for sure.
Well, you know, if I was Seattle, I'd cancel a project if I thought Google was going to put it in anyway.
Yeah. So that project has already died, and they owe the city like this company owes the city like $50,000 or something like that. So it's like, yeah, it's kind of a mess, which is a huge bummer because people were really excited about it. I was excited about it. I'd submitted my info to like, you know, get my house connected and stuff. So anyways, so that's kind of interesting and bummer. And exciting, but yeah, but the other thing, the big thing that Microsoft announced was their version. It's a hybrid of Siri and Google Now called Cortana.
Uh-oh. Okay.
And basically, it's like Siri in that it takes a lot of control over allows you to do a lot of things on your phone, like say, wake me up tomorrow at 7 a.m., or can find, you know, find the what's the best Mexican restaurant in Seattle. That was one of the things that they did. And so it enables you to do that, but it also, because it's basically being on the back end, it gives you the power to do things like what Google Now does or Wolfram Alpha, where they were able to, he asked, he said, how many calories are in a banana, right? And it popped it all up, it popped up all that information. And so.
I'm going to ask Siri right now.
Ask Siri how many calories are in a banana?
Uh-huh. Let's try it.
Okay.
How many calories are in a banana?
Okay, give me a moment.
All right, folks, let's see what it goes.
The answer is about 105 dietary calories.
Yeah, so now Apple plugs in the back end to Wolfram Alpha, right?
Right.
And does a lot of that kind of stuff. So so this is interesting because it's all built on Microsoft's stack, and they control and own it. And so there's a lot of interesting things that they are able to do. What's interesting is the fact that they basically, in one fell swoop, they've achieved parity with Google Now and Siri. And so they're definitely on that same level. And the API is open and configurable, right? So you can tie in different applications. So the one that they demoed was somebody said, you know, he said, Siri, get me, you know, this person. Or not necessarily Skype, you know, connect me to this, find this person. Mm-hmm. And so they then it placed it through and bumped it over to Skype, made the connection and identified it. One thing that was interesting that they pointed out was so it scans your email. You can set it up to scan your email and alert you of like upcoming flights and things like that. But they pointed out that this is not the cloud service doing this. This is the Cortana application on your phone, only scanning what's on your phone. So they're not sending data back and forth to the cloud. Much of the processing and a lot of the indexes and the search algorithms and things stay local on your device.
That's a little counterintuitive, isn't it? Because if you lost your phone, then did you lose a lot of the stuff that you have on your phone?
So the answer to that is probably yes and no.
Because wouldn't that be the point of the cloud? So that way you don't lose your stuff.
So Microsoft allows a lot of stuff to be backed up, which is different because that's like an offline like binary that you can then pull back down. And Microsoft actually has some really great restore features for their phones.
Right.
Again, it's really easy to get like text messages and things back. So I don't know exactly how that works. They didn't totally detail it, but it's interesting that they pointed out that they're keeping a lot of things local on the device so that it's not just being routed back up to the cloud service. And then if you remove the Cortana application, it all goes away.
Wow.
So, but the one thing that they did was really interesting and is that he put in a reminder. He said, you know, next time I talk to my sister, remind me to compliment her on her dog. And then he kind of said, okay, next time you talk to whatever his sister's name, it inferred who his sister was and then said, we'll remind you, right? And then he kind of like goes on, like, oh, that's disappointing. About 25 minutes later, his sister calls, right? You know, sister calls. And it pops up right there on the thing and said, remember to compliment her on her dog.
That's clever.
That was very clever. And so what they've done is, in a lot of ways, they've very much achieved, like I said, parity with a lot of programs and demonstrated that not only in some areas are they a little bit ahead and maybe a little bit better, but that because this is all built on their stack and their technology, that it's just continuously getting better. It's going to continuously get better. So,
well, let's hope so.
Yeah. So that was fun. So, you know, I've been on the fence about the next phone that I get. Am I going to go back to iOS? Am I going to go to Android? Am I going to stay with Windows Phone? And so unless Apple does something really awesome with iOS, not necessarily the iPhone, but something really awesome with iOS at WWDC this year. I'll stay on Windows Phone for one more rotation. And part of the reason why is that they also went and addressed their app situation. Mm-hmm. So they have basically, because for all these years that they've been working on unifying the kernel across all of their devices, unifying, building the common language runtime, building the Windows runtime, and all this stuff where they've been building all these Metro apps and kind of bifurcating these two systems, they now have the ability, and they ran a live demo where if you build an application for Windows Phone running, you know, C# and the common language runtime running on the Windows Foundation, you can port that application almost whole scale mm-hmm. to Windows PC, to Windows 8. Because they've abstracted the entirety, after all these years, they've been working to abstract their programming systems because they operate in this high-level C# language within this certain runtime that they've been building,
mm-hmm.
that they've been able to abstract away all of these different little pieces. And so now you can port. And so you can write an application and mark it as universal, right? And the store is universal now across all the different devices. So like Spotify, if I was to get, you know, the Spotify app on my Windows PC running in the Metro, it's not Metro, but you know what I'm talking about, then it would also show up. Then it could also, if it was a universal app, it would show up on the Windows Phone and it would resize. And they did a couple of live demos, and obviously there's lots of caveats with this, but they were able to take a pretty simple like sports tracker app
mm-hmm.
and basically just say target Windows Phone, say everything is shared, and then they pulled it up and they had like two or three little bugs in the UI, and that was kind of it.
Okay. You said two or three little bugs in the UI. I thought you were going to say there were no bugs in the UI at all, so that was going to be...
No. There were a couple little things that they were able then to go... But then what you can do is you define the code that's shared, right? So mm-hmm. all the application logic is shared amongst the devices. And then they were able to define, okay, now for the Windows Phone, we need to readjust these views. But it was rescaling and resizing because they were built on all these high-level frameworks. And it's similar to like what systems have been doing with PhoneGap, or even with like Mono or Xamarin for building C# applications across these devices. But Microsoft basically said, yep, we can do this because we've been building this for years.
Mm-hmm.
And this was kind of a common thread of through the whole build conference was that we've been building this stuff for years. We've been through all these pain of like rebranding all these different applications and stuff like that. We've gone through the teething, and now we're going to start. Really, you're going to start reaping the benefits of having common data access APIs to access OneDrive across all of your platforms and all of your devices. OneNote is kind of their token application where it's now across all these platforms that they've been rebuilding everything into this. And so in a sense, you look at it, and obviously it's easy to look at a keynote and just kind of say, yeah, of course, it's like that and it's all really simple. But the potential for what they're talking about is pretty phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
It's like what Apple's been shooting for a number of years. And I think Microsoft is definitely, like, I think they, you know, again, we'll have to see how things shake out once developers start banging away on it. But it seems at least theoretically that they totally beat them to the punch.
Interesting. Yeah, it's going to be fun to watch this mm-hmm. event unravel over the next few
yeah.
months and just see how things pan out.
Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely. We'll see how this once it gets into the wild. But it was a really exciting keynote. And you could see a lot of the stuff where everything just started to kind of fit together. The pieces, you could see the pieces falling into place. And they announced a new update for Windows 8 that keeps just tightening and tweaking and cleaning up some of the weird little pieces. So Windows 8 is definitely here to stay, but they're really converging the platforms and fixing a lot of the little sticky points that people have. And it's especially looking at what they can do now is you realize that all the pain and the weirdness that Windows 8 brings, the unified backend between all of their different devices has a huge boon for developers to bring their applications up to speed. And I think that's really going to start driving. And in a sense, that's going to start driving these applications together. If I'm Spotify and I can write an application in which all my backend code and maybe even most of my UI code is shared between laptops, tablets, and phones. That's a huge market of devices for me to access. I mean, when they said Windows 8 has, you know, so their slide was Windows 8 has a bigger market share than all versions of OS X.
Mm-hmm.
So if I can do that and with a little bit of extra code also get mobile, that's a pretty big incentive for developers. So
it can be, yeah. But I wonder how many people actually pay for applications in the Windows.
Actually, they did. The last study that I saw showed that Windows Phone users pay significantly more.
Really?
Than other people. Yeah, and part of that might be because of scarcity, that they're willing to reward and pay for an application that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
But supposedly they're seeing, you know, they were talking about huge revenue growths and stuff for developers and users and things. But
from a developer's perspective, that would be a good thing. But from a consumer perspective, wouldn't that be kind of a bad thing that you have to pay more for an app that? There's always some kind of a trade-off, it seems like.
There's always a trade-off, but I think what they're talking about now is the fact that there exists this, that in the scarcity market, this is basic supply and demand, that with low supply, there's high demand for really quality applications that people are willing to reward people for, mm-hmm. The hope is that it incentivizes developers to put applications there because they can charge more for, they get more per unit than they can on iOS or Android. But then, of course, as that brings additional developers, then with competition, that drives prices down. Again, theoretically, that's how this works. So
mm-hmm.
you can help get developers in there, and then as competition comes, it'll drive, like, those prices will drive down. But as the OS and as the apps kind of develop parity, then you're hoping to grow, that grows kind of a chicken and the egg thing.
Yep.
And so this can, I think, this has the ability to really be beneficial and to see a lot of developers start porting. They also announced some really cool tools of saying, we know that you have all your old school Windows logic for your applications, but it's not, we don't care about that. We want you to be touch enabled. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a way for you to wrap all of your backend logic basically into these like private containers and then write your UI in the Windows forms or whatever they call it, and then just like hook into your data backend. So all that logic that you've been working on for years, all that weird crappy code that's tested and validated, we don't care. We're going to let you run that even if it's not the best. We just want you to get your UI up to speed. And I think that's going to be a huge boon for developers of being able to say, cool, I'll rewrite my GUI because I can target that as a brand new release. Maybe it doesn't do anything different on the backend, but I can sell more copies of it. And now I'm Windows aware. And so I think that's going to start driving that. And I think games are going to be a big one. If they can show good performance as running like these, running within kind of this Windows, with the Windows platform, then I think you could start seeing, oh, well, if I can do this in Steam and run everything in the Windows platform, can I also then take my games and push them to tablets and phones as well?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the position tied in with Xbox. You have the ability to position Windows Phone as a really strong gaming platform. In which case, then you're talking about you're competing with Nintendo and the PlayStation, the PS Vita. But now you're also saying, but you could also do all the other phone things that you like to do.
Right.
And most people that I know who touch Windows Phone love it as the OS itself. The issue that they have is applications.
The
GUI is gorgeous. And the way that it works and links information across, it's so much more intuitive and so much more fluid. And then if you can give them a killer application, like mm-hmm. the ability to do games across their platforms and stuff like that, then that can be.
But perhaps the core issue here doesn't have to do with the technology. It has to do with who the focus is.
Yeah.
It seems like with Microsoft, the focus is still the developers. They're helping them. They're making mappers to help developers mm-hmm. get apps out there. But I think maybe Android even and Apple seem to focus more on the user experience.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, people just want iPhones and they want Android phones because yeah. – they know it's going to work, and they know it's going to work the way they expect it to work, yeah. and it's going to be a good experience for them.
And it's very true. And Apple has been very clear about the fact that they care about the user.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been hearing like a lot of complaints about developer relations and developer tools and stuff like that, and especially on the Apple platform.
Oh, for sure. Like as a developer, I definitely come second.
Yeah. But I think, and again, this is my, you know, my bias coming through. Absolutely. I would argue that Microsoft can focus on the developers because it has the consumer side. People like Windows Phone. They like picking it up and they like touching it. Everybody that I've shown it to, or all my friends that have looked at it, all are like, oh, this is really awesome. And then what it comes down to is I can't get my favorite application. There's no Instagram. Mm-hmm. There's no, my bank doesn't have their app on here. I can't, you know, whatever it is, slice and dice it however you want, that doesn't exist on my platform.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you solve that problem? You incentivize developers to put their stuff on their application. And, you know, the big thing that I noticed was that they were talking about the Facebook app. And they started saying, Facebook, we've been working with Facebook, or Facebook has been doing this. Microsoft has written the Facebook app because Facebook couldn't be bothered.
Mm-hmm.
But is it really true that Facebook is now on board with the with this? Vine has their application on there. I don't know. But if we're starting to see some of the big developers come on board, then that's really interesting and really exciting.
That's a good sign, yeah.
And so in that case, you already have the consumers because you have a really great platform that just got even way better. You have a fundamentally different way of doing. Some people don't like it. I haven't met anybody who really doesn't like Windows Phone, but I can understand why not, because it is a fundamentally different way of working on a platform. And people may not really like it, but I think a lot of people do. And so now if you're starting to address, like, filling in the holes, the application holes that are existing, I think you have a really solid product. And so I think Microsoft is taking the right approach of saying, we're going to get the apps on here.
Mm-hmm.
And if we already know that we have a great OS, and if we have the apps, that's the one thing that people are always complaining about. And if we can fix that, then.
Okay. So I think their plan is starting to become a bit more clear now.
Mm-hmm. And they've been doing this, and now you're kind of seeing, like, we've been doing all of this. All the stuff that we've been doing, it's been fits and starts, and it's been painful, and it's been weird. And we've rebranded OneDrive, SkyDrive, LiveDrive, you know, 37 times. But now it's OneDrive, and it links common data APIs across all these platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been working with Office, and now Office connects. Office is kind of weird, and we know you've been struggling, but now we can show that we have PowerPoint feature parity on the phone, or at least viewing on the phone and on your tablet and on your laptop. So you create a presentation in PowerPoint, and you can display it on all the devices, and it works perfectly.
Hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
Cool beans. So you mentioned Facebook, and I recall that they wrote their own language recently.
They did,
released it. It's called Hack, right?
Hack, yes.
I haven't read too much about this, but maybe you can fill me in a bit.
Yeah, so Hack is kind of something that they've been working on. It's kind of the evolution of a bunch of things. So Facebook is written in PHP,
mm-hmm.
which originally and kind of is written in PHP, because that's what Zuck knew, the Zuck. And then they started scaling and realized it was really slow. So they wrote it's called Hip Hop, which basically you take PHP and you compile it down to C code, you compile it to a binary and run it. It actually worked pretty well. So the Facebook is just one giant binary that they just copy onto all the machines. And that's how it runs. And everything is contained in this one binary file. In a sense, it was actually kind of forward looking. So that's how Go works. So Golang, you get, unless you're linking in C code, everything that's done in Go is just one binary that you just push out to wherever you go.
Hmm.
It's kind of awesome. Makes deliverables really easy. So that was getting kind of funky. So they created HHVM, or a hip hop virtual machine,
mm-hmm.
where they took all that and converted it and created like a JIT, like what .NET has, or Java, JavaScript, that kind of stuff. And so that works really well. And a lot of people got really on board with it because it was so fast and so awesome. You could run, you could run WordPress in it, you could run Wikipedia, and it was just way faster than any of the other runtimes. But then that still wasn't working enough for them. So they created their own language called Hack, which is basically PHP with type declaration. So imagine Cython, Yeah, Cython's a really good one. JavaScript has it. They have like ASM.js ASM.js
mm-hmm.
allows you to add compiler hints and stuff like that. So what's different is they call it gradually typed, which means that you can start, and you can start with fully dynamic code, just traditional PHP, and then start adding type declarations as you go, and then kind of add that gradually over time. And each time you do so, you know, you get a little bit better compiler optimization, a little bit better hints, and then you end up with something that's basically fully statically typed at some point.
Huh.
And so they have converted their entire, they said their entire, all their code is now hack. They've converted it all to hack.
That's interesting, because that is basically the way I used to program in industry. I would mock up the code essentially in Python, get it to work, and then once I got it to work, I'd figure out, you know, and we knew what the features were, you know, what we wanted, and the people I was delivering to were happy with it. I started to write C code and then connect it with Cython, and it was just, or Pyrex or whatever it was. I forget. I think you used to use both of them or one or the other. It depends on the actual job at hand. But either way, I would replace the functions in my Python code with C functions and make system calls to C. And that would run my code much, much faster. And eventually I'd end up with like a Python wrapper with a bunch of C functions.
Yeah.
And that would be much, much faster than just the Python code. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, so hack is the next evolution, the next step on top of that kind of stuff. It's really it makes sense on where you're going. There's a couple of things that are interesting about it. One, they claim it's the world's first gradually typed language, mm-hmm. which I don't think is true. I'm pretty sure that Google Dart is also gradually typed. So Dart is basically the same thing. It's written by the guys that were writing. It's created by the guys in Denmark who were doing the JavaScript VM, basically. And so they decided that they were profiling lots of different, they had like thousands and thousands of samples of JavaScript. And they looked at it and basically found that there are certain subsets of the code that perform really well and certain subsets that aren't. And they kind of got tired of a lot of these problems that people were running into, so they created Dart as a way to get around that. And so Dart is a language, it either compiles to like static, like binary, and then runs within the Dart VM, which is in Chrome, or it compiles to Java, or, you know, compiles to JavaScript and runs as JavaScript on all sorts of, on everything else. Mm-hmm. But of course, it compiles down to that subset of JavaScript that runs really well and really quickly. What's interesting about it is that I also believe that you can add static typing, because static typing is all the rage these days.
Uh-huh.
But I'm pretty sure, and I don't know for sure, I've looked a little bit at Dart, but I haven't dug too far into it. It also allows you to gradually add typing over time. But what's interesting about both of these languages is that both of them are technically open source,
mm-hmm.
but both of them are very much run and controlled by their respective companies. And so as a developer looking to build applications in these, I'm kind of hard pressed to, I'm very wary of building anything within these platforms, largely because there's nothing, Dart is not central to Google's workflow. Hack is central to Facebook's workflow, but they don't care if you're fixing any, adding features or fixing bugs or whatever. None of the development is done in the open. Basically, it's kind of like what Google does with Android. The Android open source project is they kind of are slowly pushing chunks of updates to the source tree. But it's not like they're developing on GitHub or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas languages like Google's Golang is all done. It's 100% open source. And everything is being done. In fact, several members of the key team are from some of the guys at Ubuntu and some of these other places. Or Canonical, I guess it is. So it's like a full open source project. Everything's done in the open. So these are a little bit different. And so as you're writing stuff on Hack, they're diverging from PHP just a little bit. So then there's no indication that that's not going to get worse over time, or that Facebook is going to expand upon things that don't benefit them. Likewise with Dart, Google could very much just like pull the rug out from under people, like they did with like Google Reader and like a couple of their other products, where they're just like, nope, we're done. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And so Dart is a little bit more interesting to me. I like to see it kind of expand, see if that takes off and get some traction outside the community, because it has that potential to be really fully open source. But Hack is something that seems to be Facebook saying, we got all this work, and so we have all this PHP code, we're not going to move to something else. we're going to, you know, we're just going to dump it. And we're just gonna create hack and kind of go from there.
Interesting.
It seems kind of like a hack.
Yeah, I wonder if the language itself is a hack.
It's basically PHP. Literally is PHP with... I mean, you can take PHP code and start adding static typing, it becomes hack code.
You know, to be completely honest with you, I haven't coded in PHP since I was maybe 14 years old. It's been quite a while.
I haven't done much PHP code, much at all, and I haven't touched it in 4 or 5 years. So I was never a big fan. I didn't really like it.
Me neither.
I know that there's lots of people that do like it and that it's solid and it's well tested and stuff. I mean, I touch it every now and then because I run, you know, WordPress, so sometimes I'll dig in and so I'm familiar with some of the basic syntax. I couldn't really like write much of it, but so I can't hand down judgment because I don't do much PHP, haven't done any hack, and I don't do a lot of Dart. I've only looked at Dart real briefly. So this is just kind of observations from the outside. But comparing to other languages, so like Go. So supposedly Google is rewriting a lot of their stuff from C++ to Go, in a sense of saying instead of trying to just like keep hacking on C++, they're basically saying this is new, this is better, we're going to go to this.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's really maybe if Facebook had come up with something like a new language and said, you know, basically this is better and we're porting our code base to this, even though we know that it's a lot of work, but we're gonna jump into that. Then I might look at it and say, okay, that recognizing that technology is going in a different direction. But working with hack kind of basically says we're trying to take the past and just kind of like bring it up to speed. And maybe that's the best way to do it, but it doesn't necessarily seem so wise.
It's so interesting how as time goes on, we have more and more languages cropping up.
Yep.
And they're all very specialized to companies. Google has Go. Facebook has hack.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
Microsoft has C#, F#. What's the other big one that they have? Like, man, I looked up a bunch of the stuff that runs in the common language runtime. There's a lot of stuff.
Objective-C for Apple.
Is all about Objective-C. So the difference with... So C# is now defined by an international body called ECMA or something like that. Same with F#. F# is 100% open source. That is... The guy who created F# obviously works at Microsoft, but it's very adamant, don't call it Microsoft F#. It is F#. It's run by the F# Foundation, which is kind of stands on its own, like all this kind of stuff. So so that's kind of interesting. So yeah, everybody creates their own languages and solves problems that they need to solve. But there are only a few, I think, that'll shake out in the long term. And I mean, even R came out of S, which was created by Bell Labs. But that quickly moved into the community. Yeah, so it'd be interesting to see how things shake out in the long run. But
I just popped up my browser really quick, and I'm checking out F# on the F# Foundation website, and it looks very. I can see why people might mix up or call F# Microsoft F#. Mm-hmm. You know, the visuals and stuff look very Microsoft-ish, like out of Excel or out of maybe GNU Plot. Although that's not from Microsoft.
No.
I think
it's developed by Microsoft in their principal languages group. So it's core, it's foundational to Microsoft now. So of course it's going to have that kind of slant to it. But I think they've been really working to move outside of the traditional Microsoft realm, which is good. It's interesting. So we'll see how that goes. That one is, it keeps popping up. I keep seeing it arrive places, and you can go to tryfsharp.org and play around with it. They have a really great demo site, like absolutely phenomenal. And so I played around with it a little bit. I really enjoyed it. It's kind of a fun language. So I'm looking for some projects to kind of dig around on it and try it out. So.
Cool. Yeah, I'm looking at all the libraries, the open source libraries, the commercial libraries.
Yeah.
Looks pretty interesting. Lots of math and stats libraries.
Yeah, absolutely. It's heavy use in... and especially finance. A lot of finance applications are written in it, some exploratory data analysis, that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of things that it lends itself really, really well to. Now, again, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around functional programming as a concept. That's a little bit opaque to me, but I think once I can kind of figure that out, then we'll have a lot more uses for it.
There's one library called math.net, which supports special functions, linear algebra, probability models, random numbers, interpolation, integration, regression, optimization problems, and more.
Hmm.
Sounds pretty fancy.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, hey, we are we're about an hour 10 here, so it's probably time that we start wrapping this up, especially since the audio probably sounds like two gophers in a gutter. Yeah, well, thank you guys. Thank you, folks, for hanging out, and we'll be back again next week, and hopefully with some better equipment. And again, any feedback or comments, I know a lot of the stuff we say on here is, some of it is founded in a bit more of a correct mindset, or at least an idea of what's going on, but a lot of our stuff is just kind of us shooting off the cuff here. So if we ever say anything that you think is wrong or needs to be expounded upon or anything, we'd love to get feedback and open a dialogue with some people. We're always about learning and expanding and understanding better.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at @informatonauts.
Yep. And then you can also follow me at Nick Robison.
Or you can follow me at Nikhil Gopal.
Yeah, we'd love to hear back from you guys. And again, thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
Have a good week, guys.